Okay, we are just coming on to 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all. You will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you have a question or comment, re-mute yourself afterwards so that we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, the contents of the deck in PDF format, the chat contents, as well as the audio track will be posted on our website. So if anybody joined us just at the last couple of minutes here, again, welcome. If you're new to the ROPC user group, we welcome guests at any time. Feel free to join us at any of our meetings. If you want to join and support our operations and that, if you join in the next few days up until the end of the month, you will actually get 2 years for the price of one. So for the $20, you'll get a 2 year membership rather than 1 year. I pasted the link to that in the chat, and you can also just go to our website, and on the homepage at the top, there'll be a join or renew link. Just follow that, and you can join up. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris. We have a couple of brand new presenters to Q&A anyway, tonight, so that's really good. Looking forward to that. However, in the meantime, I've got another YouTube tech item from computer history. You may remember last week I talked about a video that that discussed GNU and Linux, and you'll recall that GNU is an acronym created by Richard Stallman for GNU is not Unix. So this week the YouTube video of choice is all about Unix. Unix was developed at Bell Labs, which at the time belonged to AT&T. And this particular video, the Unix operating system, basically discusses the history of how Unix was developed and how it all fell apart in the Unix wars and so on and so forth. So if you have any interest in the prehistory of GNU and the Linux kernel, then this is the video which tells you all about actual Unix. Okay, second thing I have is a follow-up from the item we had last week, which was the fact that Office software, the Word and PowerPoint, etc., suddenly lost their recent files list. And it turned out that this was a bug. When I checked on the web, there were a number of people complaining of exactly the same problem. And this one in particular suggested that Office 365 had been updated the day before this happened, and presumably that was the reason. So I thought that maybe it was only applicable to 365, but Chris tells me that Linda's problem was actually with Office, I think it was 2021. So yep, it was various Office products that suddenly lost the recent files list. And the problem there, of course, is that Office sometimes does updates in the background and doesn't tell you about it. So this is probably what happened. They did an update and there was some bad software in there. And sure enough, a few days later, there was another update in the background, which nobody told us about, and the problem was fixed. And here you can see I've got some recent files. However, the fix didn't actually return things to normal, or at least it didn't return them to their historical values. So it didn't restore old items that were in the recent file list. It just, if you open a new file, and it added that to the list. So you can see here that I got several files in the list, but they're all like I opened them in the last minute or so. And the other problem is that if you had pinned items, files and folders, so that you could navigate to these quickly, and those also weren't restored. So, and that wasn't a problem for me. I only ever look at probably the last item or two in the recent files list. I don't use the pinned items, but if that's a thing that people use a lot, then unfortunately you lost that capability for a little while. Anyway, all is well again, I think, now. So going forwards, the recent file lists will build up and the pinned items may stay pinned for a while.
It's interesting. I haven't seen any mea culpa from Microsoft on that one. But they don't seem to have admitted to the fact that they screwed up at all.
Oh, I'm sure they didn't. Must have been the internet gremlins.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. The internet gremlins at Redmond, Washington, yeah. Okay, we have another kind of follow-up from some discussion that we had last week, and Chris has got some information on tag tracking.
Yeah, this started up on the member forum, so a bit of a plug for the member forum, a place that people can discuss anything computer-related. You must be a member in order to join that, but it is an opportunity to share information and ask questions and all that sort of thing outside of Q&A. So this came up. Alan posted something about this tag tracking system, and there was a bit of discussion that went on. Stefano Richard contributed to the discussion because he's actually taken part in this and knew a little bit of information. So it turns out that some insurance companies, and this was on the news today, by the way, CTV News, local news, had a story about the tag tracking system and the problem where some insurance companies are adding up to $500 high theft vehicle surcharge for certain vehicles. So things like the Honda CR-V and Range Rovers and things like that. They are frequently stolen. And so now insurance companies are deciding that on renewal, all of a sudden you end up with $400 or $500 extra charge that's a surcharge, unless you equip this, your car with this tag tracking anti-theft recovery system. Next. So the cost to install it, Alan had it at $347. It seems like there is not necessarily a one-size-fits-all. Some people reported slightly different pricing, but Alan was told that this should be for any vehicle, but I think maybe don't count on it being exact. One thing is, if you are selling your vehicle, according to the website, you can transfer that registration for a $50 fee so that the new owner can take advantage of the fact that it has this anti-theft recovery system built in. Next.
Yeah, and the one-time fee there, Chris, if you go to the website, you will not find the price listed.
Yeah.
You pretty well have to call the installer and see how much it's going to be.
Yeah. The website doesn't have a lot of information, I find. So this is a quote from Tag Tracking. So this is what they say. It's North America's most effective stolen vehicle tracking and recovery system. Sounds wonderful. Next. So what they do is they install 10 to 20 RFID tags installed throughout the vehicle. And it'll vary from one installation to another, so thieves won't get to know that, oh yes, there are always these RFID tags, and this is where they're located. They'll be installed anywhere within the vehicle. And they are apparently active tags in that they do have a battery with them, but a little bit more on that later. So according to the website, again, they say devices can be tracked anywhere in North America, and they just state it that way, and I have more to say on that a little bit later on, too. In addition to installing the trackers, what they'll do is they'll do a logo etching on your windows, and that's meant to be a deterrent for thieves. So thieves will see that, you know, this vehicle has got tag tracking installed on it. They will know that this is, you know, the most effective stolen vehicle tracking and recovery system in North America, and so therefore they'll move on to somebody else's high theft vehicle rather than steal yours. Mm. At least that's the theory. Next. So it is that one-time fee. And again, it seems like the cost may be dependent on the vehicle as well as potentially the insurance company that you have. Next. So Stefano Richard reported on this. He says that if a vehicle is stolen, and this was sort of confirmed by Alan, what you do is you call the police and you get a police report. Then you call tag tracking with the police report number. And then tag tracking finds your vehicle. And this is where things get a little bit murky as to exactly what they're doing and how they're doing it. But when they find your vehicle, they call the insurance company. They don't tell you about this. They call the insurance company and basically they say, we found this stolen vehicle that is reported in police report XYZ for a vehicle that you have insured. Now, you can pay us a fee for the information about where this vehicle is located, or you can just ignore that and go pay the owner of the vehicle for this stolen vehicle. Next.
Sounds like an extortion.
Yes. So tag installers, this is a quote from Alan, very reticent to divulge any details of the system. And I can see a little bit why, you know, they don't want the thieves to know too much about the system. He did get confirmation that the tags do have batteries, so they are not passive RFID tags, which is actually a good thing, because passive tags can only be read from very short distances. And active tags, I read one place where they said up to 100 feet away or more. They say that many factors can affect the read range, including buildings, trees, various obstacles, even weather apparently can affect the ability or the distance at which an RFID tag can be read. Some sources I read indicated the tags have a read range of 300 feet or more. And this got me to thinking, where they said the devices can be tracked anywhere in North America. Well, if the tags can only be read from somewhere around 300 to 1,000 feet away, how is it that they are tracking vehicles anywhere in North America? That's what they say. I have no way to challenge them or anything like that, but I seriously question whether they can really track things anywhere in North America. The warranty, they do have a warranty on it. Warranty is not necessarily as good as you might think it is. It's for 5 years, and what it is if the stolen vehicle is not recovered, they'll install the tag system into the replacement vehicle at no charge. So that's the level of the warranty for it. Next.
That's the degree of confidence in the best system in North America, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. So some final thoughts on this system, and this is just more or less off the top of my head as well as Alan, you know, in our discussions back and forth a little bit, side notes about it. The lack of detail really doesn't help people to understand whether there is any benefit to this system or not. You know, is it really worth $300 to $400? Personally, I think it's questionable at best as to whether it's really worth $300 to $400. From the way this system works, you know, the website only talks about the successes, of course, but it doesn't even talk about why it was a success or anything like that, or if it was only in certain neighborhood locations that they managed to locate them. I don't know. You know, you just don't have an awful lot of information. Next. But as Alan found out, insurance companies, some of the insurance companies will actually pay for the installation of the tag system and remove the insurance surcharge for vehicles that are frequently stolen. So at that point, it doesn't cost you anything to actually have this system installed. So if that's the case, well, why not? It may be a deterrent to thieves, in which case it's a good thing. If your vehicle does get stolen, maybe you'll get it back, as opposed to getting reimbursed whatever the insurance company is going to reimburse you for the stolen vehicle. So overall, if somebody else is paying for everything, why not? But if you're on the hook for any of that, you know, I think it's really questionable whether it's worth it or not. Next. And then Alan had this in our side discussions on this. He says, you know, the bigger question is really, you know, vehicle thefts are really, really a huge problem right now. And they're on the news frequently, and it is causing insurance rates to go up and all the rest of it. And so, you know, what can be done to prevent vehicle theft? Maybe something like a third-party immobilizer. Or what about, and I'll throw this one out, I thought this was pretty cool, two-factor authentication system requiring that you have a pre-programmed flash drive plugged into the vehicle in order to start the vehicle. That might be, you know, a pretty robust method of preventing vehicle theft. Who knows? But anyway, you know, it's just thrown out there as an idea of, like, you know, does people have an idea about, you know, what can be done to prevent vehicle theft? So that's all we have on the tag tracking. And if you have a high theft vehicle in your possession, get ready for your next insurance renewal. You'll probably end up with a big surcharge on there and an order that if you want to avoid it, that you have to get tag installed.
Yeah, one I looked into this a little bit, and apparently the way they track them is they have RFID readers set up at different places where there's lots of traffic. I would imagine something like airport parking lots, maybe downtown city corners or something. But so they track your vehicle in the sense that they know if it's gone into that parking lot or at least gone by their reader. So it all really depends on whether they have, you know, 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 readers across the continent.
Yeah.
And they're only going to know that it passed by. They won't know where it's sitting unless it's a parking lot.
Yeah.
I did a little bit of looking into this as well. And what I discovered is there were actually two types of tracking devices. One was RFID. And there was a separate one which relied entirely on GPS and was a monthly subscription fee. Interestingly, Nancy and I bought a new Hyundai Tucson, and it comes equipped with BlueLink, which your it uses the GPS built right into the car. And if you have the BlueLink app installed on your device, you could actually see where the vehicle was on Google Maps. And I used it quite a bit because Nance had to come back to the city one day a week to work and I would be at the cottage. And when she was arriving, I could see exactly where she was on the highway. And, you know, I'd know, okay, she's about 2 minutes out. I could see the car coming right in the cottage road in real time. Unfortunately, they updated the app and my Android 8 phone no longer supports the app. So it's rendered, they rendered it useless by virtue of the Google Play update. So the answer is I have to buy a new phone if I want to use it. But it's built right into some cars. Anyway, that's what I found on that AirTag thing.
Well, regarding that, you look into it a little bit more. There may be a website or something that will substitute for the app, because often they're developed in tandem, because a lot of the development for Android is HTML.
And there actually is. I can access on the web. I can access it to start the car, lock the car, blow the car horn, check whether the doors are open. The only thing that I can't access on the web is the GPS location, sadly. So, if I go buy a new phone, apparently it will work.
Also one aspect of these theft is that they come about because you have a vehicle that starts with pushing a button, because a key fob tells the car you're there. But the key fob, what they do to steal it is that they actually steal the key fob signal from outside your house or restaurant, and they amplify it and they play it back to your car, and then they get in and drive it away. So one thing you can do is put your keys inside of what's called a Faraday cage, which is basically just a metal field. And you can get these foam things that your keys will automatically go into. Or if you have like a little metal cookie tin, you can put that at the door and put all your keys in there when you come home, for example. But I know that the guy who runs RV Lifestyles, he had his RV broken into while he was in a restroom. And they used the same method. They stole his signal, used it to unlock the RV, and then stole all his AV equipment.
Right. Okay, great discussion, but we better move on. We've got a lot more material to cover as well.
Okay, so next up we have an item from Carol Pearson. And Carol, you're going to share your screen and tell us all about Microsoft's snipping tool.
And you can unmute yourself.
You're unmuted, Carol.
Yep.
Yes. Okay, now I'm using presenter view. Can you see it?
We just see the presentation on the slides, yeah.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so I was recently decided to do this presentation for a 50th anniversary for a club. And I was gathering some old historical items. And I was given an old CD that was done for the 35th anniversary in 2009. And on the CD, there were some pictures all the way back to 1978. So my dilemma was, how do I get the pictures off this CD? I played the CD. I tried right-clicking on each picture to try and take a screenshot. That didn't work. I tried taking pictures with my phone of the pictures on the computer. Of course, that didn't work. I asked a few people. Nobody seemed to have any ideas. And so I finally Googled it, and I found the snipping tool. And so the problem is, and I found the snipping tool. And I just love new discoveries. So where do you find the snipping tool? A snipping tool is a Microsoft Windows screenshot utility included in Windows Vista or later. It can take still screenshots of an open window, rectangular areas, a freeform area, or the entire screen. Videos can also be snipped. Snips can then be annotated using a mouse or a tablet, stored as an image file. The default is a PNG, or can be saved as a JPEG as well, or an HTML file, or emailed. And just so you know, I'm using Windows 11. Okay. Where do you find the snipping tool? So you can go to Start or go to where your apps are. Scroll down and you will see the snipping tool. You can also, if you enable, just as a side, if you enable the print screen button, that will also take a screenshot of your desktop, or it will bring up the snipping tool. You can also press the Windows logo key, Shift key, and S key, and that will bring up the snipping tool. So when you go to the snipping tool, this is what shows up on your desktop. And as you see, to activate the snipping tool, it says to press the Windows logo key, the Shift key, and the S key. So you can take a screenshot, but also a snip, a document, a photo, or a video. It has far more flexibility than a screenshot. So here is one of my favorite topics, is border collies, dogs. So say I want to just select the picture of the little guy laying down. So to snip a photo, you underline the camera. As you can see, can you see my mouse? You underline the camera that's underlined with the blue line. And then you would press the Windows logo key, Shift key, and the S key to start a snip. And this is what will show up. So this is when you press those keys, you will get this selection. And then you can press to do a square, a snip, a screenshot. You can do a freeform screenshot. You can do a window or a rectangle. So you choose your snip type. And so this is the dropdown of the different types of snips that you can do. And this is what you get when you snip in those different formats. Chris pointed out to me that if you save a snip in a different format, the free form, then you can get a different background. So if you save a snip, a free form snip picture, you can see that I've free formed the border collie in both pictures. But the one that's saved as the JPEG, the whole background is saved as white. whereas the one that's saved as the ping, whatever, the background is transparent so that it would give you more flexibility in using those pictures. You can also snip a video. So there's a few steps. First, if you want to, I found it helpful to enable the timer to snip a video. So that if you go, you have to have the, you have to underline the camera and then the drop down for the time and then go to the timer, which is on the other side, and pick a delay. That allows the video to, allows you to get everything ready before you snip the video. And then you go back. So you have to be on camera for that. Then you move to record a video. And then as you see down below, the little bar shows up at the top where it says to record a video. You highlight the video camera, select new, highlight the frame of the video on the screen, and then make sure also in the settings that you've enabled the sound if that is desired. And then that recording bar is there, and you hit start, and it will record. And so this is a video I recorded. I snipped and recorded. So the three dots on the snipping tool, the three dots to the right, it is a drop down for open file and settings. The settings is where you can choose, you have to enable the sound for the video. And here's the list of the things that are under setting. It includes how you want to save your screenshots, whether you want to save it every time, whether you want to save multiples. There's the thing for turning on the sound. There's a link to go to your Windows keyboard settings to enable the print screen to take a screenshot. And there are all my pictures that I got off that CD. I put them in a JPEG format, and I'll put them on a thumb drive for safekeeping. And I was very happy to find the snipping tool.
Okay, thanks very much, Carol. And
yep.
Tom's made a note here in the chat that UrbanView, which is a digital image editor, has a batch mode which will convert all the photos on a photo CD. So I guess you could kind of rip them all and make them into individual JPEGs using something like that.
Okay, where is that?
It's called UrbanView.
Okay, I'll look it
up. The information's in the chat window.
Okay, great, thanks.
Okay, so thank you very much again, Carol. That was a great presentation. I love the snipping tool. I use it all the time. And to follow up on that, I've got an Android version of more or less the same thing. I just remind everybody that we're always interested in learning about the applications and utility programs that you find useful, including apps for Android and various programs for the PC. So if, like Carol, you have something that's of interest to us, please let us know. So the next presentation is going to be about an Android app, and I've always found it useful to have a utility that will let me take screen captures of a smartphone. And the one I've been using is called Screenshot Easy. And it's available for Android through the Play Store. Again, it has lots of different settings. You can use it just to create an image, or you can take a video. It will do scrolling screenshots. If you have to scroll the window, it will maintain that. It will do the whole web page. And one of the nice things is it has multiple triggers, so you can set it basically to fire the way that you would like it. And it also has a built-in image editor. Now, I don't use a lot of those different features, but I basically use it as it comes. So by default, the trigger is a kind of an overlay of the icon, this little camera, which shows up on the screen. And if you tap that icon, then it will take a screenshot. Now, occasionally there are situations where Android doesn't show you that overlay. And now it has a, you'll see here, it has a bunch of different things. You can set various buttons and combinations to trigger the screenshot. What I like is shaking the phone. So sometimes I turn that on, and if I can't see the icon, I can just shake the phone, and that will trigger the program to take the screenshot for me. So it's really easy once you load the software. And you have this start capture button, the blue one on the top here. Then you just hit that overlaid icon to take screenshots. And when you're finished, you can take as many as you want. When you're finished, you just hit the big red stop capture button, and that completes the process. And you'll probably find your images are stored in the pictures folder with the screenshots subfolder. So if you look in there, you'll probably find the ones you're looking for. And basically how you do that is like this. Here's an example of my home screen. There's kind of the overlay. So I tap on the image there. I shouldn't tap with my mouse. That changes the screen. I tap on the image and it takes this screenshot of the whole screen and stores it as a JPEG with a date and timestamp basically as the file name. So that's actually quite useful. Okay, so next up we have an example of that using an app called Makes You Fluent, and this is from Allison. So Allison, you probably need to unmute your microphone to be able to talk to the slides. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Alan. And thank you very much, Chris, for preparing these slides for me. So this is about an app called Makes You Fluent, which is an AI language learning app. And there are other similar apps. This is the one that I just chose to try, not for any particular reason. I didn't really know much about them. So I work in a bilingual environment, and I do use French a lot at work. But recently, I've wanted to try to become more fluent and practice speaking so that it came more naturally to me and hopefully make less mistakes. I wanted to practice discussing more complex topics, building my vocabulary, practice using the correct verb, tenses, syntax, things like that. So I was looking for a way to do this without a class or, you know, scheduling time with a tutor. Those are also more expensive. So, I just wanted an unstructured way to practice speaking French without feeling self-conscious, but still get corrections and feedback. So this app's only available on mobile. It's not available for a laptop or desktop. And there's a number of languages available. And it is a fee subscription. I started just with 1 month just to see if I even liked it and would use it. And now I have a 6 month subscription. I've been using it for about 4 months and I do use it pretty much every day. So when you first make an account, you just answer a few questions and complete a few simple tests in the language that you've picked to help establish your level. Next. So when you first open the app, I have it on my phone, you get a welcome screen. There's a list of topics you can choose to practice. There's actually a lot of topics. I usually use the freeform chat one. And then once you choose a topic, you have a screen with three choices. I find the vocabulary and sentences are at a very beginner level. I always use the interactive chat because I want to practice speaking. Next. So this is new since I started using the app. There have been a few enhancements lately. So here you can choose a chat companion, and then when you go back to the same companion, it has saved your conversation. You can continue it. It didn't used to save your conversation, so I really like this. And I also like that the companions will ask you questions about what you're talking about. So I like that because sometimes I was just having a hard time thinking of things to talk about. And when I'm using it, I'm always speaking into the microphone on my phone. I don't type messages, but it types out what you say. And sometimes it will just put in random text that is not at all what I said, and I'll have to delete that. Sometimes it puts in an incorrect word that is similar to what I said, but not what I meant. That could, of course, also be because of my lack of French accent. Next. So the next few slides are just examples of conversations I've had. Here I told it that I had just watched Doctor Who with my son. This was probably from back in December when there was some new episodes on. And it asked what my favorite episode was. So I answered that. And I guess this message it was actually pretty good because it just says, "You're on the mark, keep it up." And that's typical of the encouragement that it will give. Next. And this is an example of, I think, a correction that's actually not good. I had asked it before for recommendations of French films to watch, and it had recommended the film Incendie to me. So I had watched that, and I told it that, and I said, et je l'ai aimé beaucoup. And the correction, it's saying, je l'ai aimé with an extra E on the end of aimé to match the feminine gender film. But I don't think that's right. I'm pretty sure film in French is masculine. And also I know it's small, but if you can see it says je l'ai aimé should be je l'ai aimé. And it's typing out the exact same thing twice. It does do this sometimes. So it's not perfect. But and then I asked it for recommendations of other films, which it did give me. And then next. And then sometimes it just tells me that my message is not clear. And in this example, it didn't give me any advice on how to make it, like how to make it better. Sometimes it does, though. I think that's often when I'm in my head, I'm translating directly from English to French. And of course, the syntax, the word order isn't always the same. So I think sometimes that makes the message seem not clear. Next. And then here's an example where the correction is a good one, I think. I was asking it for recommendations of places in the Caribbean for nice beaches. And I had said dans le Caribe, and it corrected it and said that it should be au Caribe. And then it did give me recommendations. Next. So, yeah, it's not perfect. Not exactly, of course, like having a real conversation with the person. It is basically texting. Also, I find it uses very proper French, which is probably what you would mostly get in a class or with a tutor as well. So it's not like really just learning to have casual conversations with people. One example is I sometimes use the phrase bon matin to say good morning, which is a phrase that I mean, a lot of people at work say that all the time. And it will tell me this is a phrase that is not used. But I have learned some different words and phrases, different ways of saying things that I now use regularly. So it's accomplishing my goal of getting me to practice speaking, helping me to become more fluent. I can speak as slowly as I need to. I can make many mistakes and I don't feel self-conscious speaking to this. And I have contacted support a couple of times and I have gotten prompt response and resolution. The app is always unfailingly encouraging and polite. So if anyone's used anything similar, I'd love to hear about it. Like I said, because I know that there are others. I don't know if others have other features that this one doesn't have. Thanks.
Okay, thanks very much, Allison. Très bien, I guess I would say.
Yeah, that was great. Thanks very much for sharing.
Yeah, it was an excellent, excellent presentation. A very interesting app, I must say.
Merci.
Okay. There's a question there somewhere? Okay, moving along then, Chris has a question, the answer to a question.
Yeah, so this came into the mailbox for suggestion box. So just a reminder that if you have anything you want to share or a question you have, send it into suggestion box at opcug.ca and we'll do what we can. If we don't have the answer or can research the answer, we'll throw it up to the group at the next Q&A. So it is tax time. And so the CRA, and this was Elizabeth, had this question. She said, when you go on there, you can sign in using a sign-in partner, or you can use a CRA user ID and password. And so she was wondering, you know, what's the benefit or downside to using sign-in partner as opposed to CRA user ID and password? So what's the theory behind using sign-in partner? Is it more secure? Is it more convenient? And is it more convenient to the bank or the taxpayer, or just what are the ramifications for this? Next. So the concept of this sign-in partner is not really unique to CRA. So many sites that you go to that require authentication will allow you to sign in using a local account to that particular site, or you'll have a button to sign in using Facebook or Google or potentially some other places where you might have an account. And they all should act more or less the same as this is going through the CRA. So if you equate this to other sites, you might see whether there's value in that for you. Next. So CRA has what they call sign-in partners. And these are CRA's words. So if you look up their frequently asked questions and so forth about sign-in partners, this is what they'll say. They'll say it's more convenient. They say that because most people have online credentials for banking or paying their bills, then maybe they want to use those same credentials to access CRA. And it really does come down to it's only a select number of banks that are on the list. You can't sign in using Facebook or Google or anything like that. So using the same credentials to access CRA means it's one less username and password that you have to remember. Next. I'll have more to say on that later. So what exactly is this? So the sign-in partner is basically a broker of the credentials, and it's actually operated by Interac. It's a bridge between Government of Canada services, and in this case in particular CRA, but it can be done on other government services as well, and participating credential service providers, the sign-in partners, and basically it's a bunch of banks. So you end up signing in using the banking credentials of whatever sign-in partner you pick. Next. So, of course, people are going to be concerned about whether there's information that is shared between CRA and the banks that are doing the authentication. And according to the CRA, username, password, and even the financial institution is not actually shared with CRA. It's all brokered through Interac, and so Interac knows who you're going to for the authentication, but CRA does not. They say that personal tax information is not shared with your financial institution, a good thing, and personally identifiable information and banking details are not shared with CRA. Next. So what are the sign-in partners? So they're on the screen there, and they say that they may be others added in the future, but you can see that they're largely financial institutions, all of the big banks and so forth on there, and some other financial institutions like Wealthsimple and Meridian, things like that. Next. So I've pasted into the chat that URL. So when you go to that and you're logging into CRA, you have an option. One is using one of the sign-in partners, and you can just click on sign-in partner. Next. Then you'll be presented with a list of all of the available sign-in partners, and in this case, I have a Tangerine account, so I clicked on Tangerine. Next. Then you get the login for Tangerine, and you can notice that here on the right-hand side, it is Interac that is actually doing the brokerage on there, but it is the Tangerine login that you're being prompted for. So you log in this exact same way as you would do when you go to that financial institution. Next. Then you'll get this terms and conditions come up, And if you want to continue to use it, you just have to blindly accept the conditions and continue. Next. And then you get the validate your identity. So this is where it ties your financial institution account to your CRA information. And so next, you have to put in your social insurance number, your date of birth, and then your tax information you have to put in from line 15,000 from the 2023 income tax and benefits return. And this is what identifies that particular login with, in my case, Tangerine. And it will link it to my tax information as it exists at the CRA. Next. Then you click on next. And then I actually get an error at that point because I already have a CRA user ID. So I can't use a sign-in partner. You have to choose one or the other. You can't end up using both. So I was sort of stymied at that point. I presume at that point you will continue on and you will be logged into the CRA site with all your tax information there. Yeah, so the last thing is, why would you not want to use a sign-in partner? And I don't like using sign-in partners on that single sign-on type things. I don't like the idea of that. The problem can crop up that if your credentials at the sign-in partner get compromised somehow, then that could mean that your Canada Revenue Agency account could also be at risk because that's what's being used to sign into CRA. So if it's compromised, then presumably whoever compromised it could also get access to your account at Canada Revenue Agency. I prefer to have separate accounts at every service and site that I use on the internet. Next. Now, if you think you have too many accounts to remember them all, use a password manager. And if you don't know how to use a password manager, next. Ottawa Public Library, I have a couple of presentations coming up that are scheduled for keeping passwords safe. Learn to use free software, stores all your usernames and passwords along with the related information. And so I'm giving it at Nepean Centerpoint and Sunnyside coming up. And so if you're interested, sign up through the Ottawa Public Library website to join me at one of those presentations. And that's all I have on that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. One thing I noticed was this signing partner thing seems to need a lot more information than if you just set up a CRA account. With a CRA account, you basically just need a login, user ID, and password.
Yeah.
And then you can use two-factor authentication. You have security questions, which are optional.
Yeah. You have to use two-factor authentication now. You can't get around that. You can get around the secret question that I believe you can do it at least for a period of time before you have to be prompted again. But they are enforcing two-factor authentication. One of the nice things about the way the CRA is doing two-factor authentication is that they allow you to set up multiple ways. And so I have both my cell number and my landline. And a lot of people go, oh, landline, well, you can't receive a text there. Well, either on my cell phone or on my landline, I can choose to have them phone it, and they will just read out the six-digit code that I just have to put in at the website. So it's really kind of nice that they have it where, you know, there's fallbacks for it. It always worries me when I have two-factor authentication. What if the means of two-factor authentication is lost, like my cell phone? Well, in this case, I could actually, you know, tell them, okay, send it to my landline, you know, and just phone me with the number that I have to put in. So it's really nice the way that they do the two-factor.
So looks like there's a few questions. Karen's asking, if you know, do you have to use the same partner every time?
I would presume that that would be the case, but maybe not. I'm not sure. I suspect it probably is. As soon as you set up one, if you try to switch to another, it's probably going to say, oh, you already have a partner in, there. But, yeah, they must have some way that you can switch, because if you switch banks or whatever, but it might require communication with CRA to get them to reset that. I really don't know.
Well, Carol says that she doesn't see all that with Toronto Dominion Bank, and Natalie says she doesn't need to have anything except a username and password with the RBC sign-in.
RBC. Oh, okay. Interesting.
Darlene says, keep in mind this is a way to have current banking information readily available to seize funds if you owe money. She worked for the tax department a few decades back. And Carol is saying there must be a way to change from a sign-on partner to just a CRA sign-on.
Yeah, I would presume so, but I don't know. It's just like they stopped me from going from a CRA sign-on to using a sign-in partner. I presume that I could probably communicate somehow with them, but they didn't give me any option to say, oh, if you want to switch, you know, do the following. They just said, no, you can't do it. So, but I'm sure if you actually contact CRA in the back, you know, it probably would take days or weeks or whatever, but I presume that all of those sort of things can get sorted out.
Well, the Sunnyside Library edition of that presentation is not on the library website.
Yes, yeah, some of the ones that are upcoming currently are not on the site yet, going in beyond the end of this month. Most of the ones that we got 22 new presentations going beyond the end of this month, and I think there's only a couple of them that are currently posted, so just keep checking back. They should be going up over the next probably couple of weeks.
So Elizabeth confirms that you have to use the same partner every time. She tried that.
Yeah.
I guess nobody seems to know whether if you start off with partners, can you switch to CRA account only? I would think you could, but I really don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Okay, no doubt. So if anybody knows the answer to that burning question, let us know and we'll do a follow-up next week. Okay, so coming up is an update from Chris on solar eclipses.
Yeah, so this came in from B, and thank you very much, B, for communicating that with me. And so she got an email forwarded to her from somebody else, and it was advice from the American Astronomical Society. And there's lots of talk now, especially coming up to the eclipse, about how don't look at the sun without solar glasses, proper protection. You can permanently damage your eyes, and you'll continue to hear that as we get up to the 8th. This particular note was a warning that there are starting to be counterfeit eclipse glasses out there. And I got to think that this has got to be the lowest of the low out there who will, for, you know, a couple of bucks, permanently damage somebody's eyes by putting out counterfeit eclipse glasses. So this note, it actually has some information on how you can spot fakes. Now, problem with that is that there's some good advice on how to catch some bad fakes, basically where look through it and just in your house, and you should be able to see absolutely nothing. Go out on a bright sunny day, you should be able to just looking around see absolutely nothing except maybe specular reflections on puddles or in metallic objects or things like that. And even that should be extremely faint. So that's great, but some are not so easy. And so they have some where they show the real ones from particular organizations and then fakes that were made up that have markings that say they're from that organization, but they're different setups on them, they're different writing or different logos and things like that. So you may potentially be able to spot a fake that they know is a fake and they've given you an exact example. But there is a problem that some fakes might be indistinguishable from real. And this is a quote from them. The only way to know for sure is to have the product tested at a laboratory that has been approved to conduct such tests by a recognized accrediting body. Well, that doesn't help an awful lot of people. You know, like, I mean, I'm not about to be able to go and take my, $3 solar eclipse glasses and then go get them tested at some approved laboratory. So I'm currently in the position where I'm looking at it as the advice they had at the first of just looking and you should be able to see nothing in normal daylight and things like that. And then I'm going to trust it from there. I did look to see on the known examples of counterfeits and mine do not match those known ones. So I'm, you know, a bit of a just, yeah, I'm trusting. I bought them at Amazon, which is not the most trustworthy store in the world by any stretch of the imagination. Certainly, if you bought them from a trusted source, such as the Canadian Astronomical Society or something like that, I would trust them. But if it's an untrusted source, be a little careful. And so I'd read the URL about the information that they have on there. And they also have links to where if you're not sure or you don't feel comfortable, you can always build a pinhole camera to view it through, a display of it onto a cardboard or whatever, where you're not exposing your eye to any danger. So just some thoughts on that. And again, thanks very much to Bea for passing on that info.
And a note here that she heard on CBC Radio tonight that the Ottawa Public Library are going to be handing out free glasses starting tomorrow.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Two per family. Well, hope you have a small family.
Yeah.
I would just not stare at the sun using these glasses. I think occasional glances at the sun are probably pretty safe.
They provide that advice at that website as well, and they say things don't change very rapidly through the eclipse, so yeah, there's no point in staring at it. So they say you should look at it for a few seconds every 3 to 5 minutes or something like that.
Because we do go out, Chris. And the sun is out, is up there all the time, and we actually glance at it all the time. So it doesn't have a permanent effect if you only glance at it for a few seconds.
Okay, thanks, Chris and everyone. So we've been talking quite a bit about OPL presentations, and I just have a couple of notes here. Just looking back, it turns out that Chris Taylor gave the very first OPL presentation on behalf of the club at the North Gloucester branch on May the 7th, 2008. And his topic was protecting your computer. And I just note that this was done in 2008, and he's giving updated versions this year in April and May at the Rosemount and Sunnyside branches. So that means that clearly nobody listens to Chris, or he wouldn't have to repeat it 17 years later or something. Alternatively, it could mean that people are getting to hear about his wonderful presentations at the library, and he's going to all these branches, and everybody's queuing up to attend his sessions. And in fact, on Monday this week, Chris gave his personal 500th OPL presentation. So congratulations, Chris. That's a remarkable milestone. I guess we look forward to the 1,000.
It might take another 17 years or so.
May 25th is in the future.
That should be March.
I'll fix that. Chris knows I'm not very good with dates these days. Okay, so we're finishing out. We've got a few minutes. If there are any more questions or comments, lots of comments here. Congratulations, Chris. Okay, so if there are no other questions, then let's start into the wrap-up for this week. And as Chris noted at the very front, we do have this 2-for-1 membership special, but it's only for a few more days. If you are a member currently of the club, then don't send any money. Your membership will automatically be extended for an additional year at no cost to you. The board has already made that decision. If you're not a member, if you pay us the $20 annual fee, we'll give you a membership, but we'll give you a second year's membership absolutely free. So you're getting 2 years for the price of one. This is a special we've had for the last few years, but we only run it until March 31st. And that's March the 31st, not May the 31st. And today is the 27th. So I think that means you've got 3 or 4 days to join the club if that's what you wish to do. And if you know anybody who would like to do that, then please let them know, because it is only good for a few more days. Okay, I still don't see anything in the chat that we need to respond to. Tom's suggesting that you really should see the total eclipse, but if it's cloudy here, I guess we're not in total eclipse yet, but drive to down to the St. Lawrence where they do have a 100% eclipse. Okay, so next meeting will be next Wednesday, which will be April the 3rd. So again, if you have questions or you have follow-up answers to some of the things we've talked about tonight, or if you have topics that you'd like to share, like Carol and Allison, and thanks again to those two for all those wonderful presentations. So anything you have to include in the next Q&A session, just send us the email to the usual spot, and we'll be sure to include you in that.